You're listening to Harris Smith Radio, Episode 7. Hey there, I'm your host, Wayne McPhail, and yes, we're back after a little bit of a hiatus, but the wait has been worth it, trust me. This time out, I talk with Mark and Ben Cullen, Canadian gardening experts and great friends of Harris Smith. As the first snow falls in this part of Canada, anyway, we discuss how to attract birds to your backyard this winter. We start with trees, offer advice on cats and squirrels, and end with citizen scientists. Next, I chat with Craig Daniels, a scientist himself who's also an expert on homebrew cider. So, an episode that takes you from grackles to apples. Told you it was worth the wait. By the way, if you want to read Harris Smith Magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrismithmag.com. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harris Smith Radio. Mark and Ben Cullen, a father and son dynamic duo of gardening expertise, have been guiding home-based horticultural fans for years, decades, and now generations. Man, I feel old. This time out, they team up to guide you to getting the best birds in your backyard. Along the way, they shatter a couple of myths, crack jokes, and diss cracked corn. Here's our chat. Hey, Mark and Ben, thanks very much for joining me. I think if I asked you guys, how do you attract winter birds in your backyards, your answer might be plant a tree 30 years ago, right? That you guys take a very sort of holistic view and very natural view. So let's talk, I want to get into feeders and things like that too, but I want to talk that broader sense. Why would having a tree or shrubbery be important for birds, especially in the winter?
Well, I have my own answer, but I'm going to let Ben kick this off because he's got his own thoughts on it. We'll see what the millennial has to say, and then maybe I'll paint in some corners.
Okay.
Well, yeah, you know, Wayne, I wasn't actually around 30 years ago to plant a tree. And we say stuff like, you know, the next best time to plant a tree is today. So right. You should still go ahead and do that. And, you know, you can buy the biggest tree you can afford, or you can just start with whatever little tree they've got that fits in the trunk of your car. But starting with a tree is definitely number one, because even a small tree can support a bird, right? And, of course, shrubbery provides necessary protection. And then there's all sorts of built solutions as well, like birdhouses and feeders. So I would say start with a tree, no matter how small.
Now, when you talk about protection, you're talking about protection from the elements, but also from predators, right?
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, habitat is one of the biggest issues for birds. I would say, you know, food is one thing, but habitat loss has been so massive and widespread over the 30 years that tree's been growing. We've lost so much boreal forest. We've lost so much even farmland, fallow field to housing development. Anything you can do to provide a place, not just to nest, that's one thing that's important, but also protection from the various other elements, right? Like cats are a huge problem. So if they're nested up high, it definitely enhances their odds of survival.
Are there any particular kinds of trees or even shrubbery that folks should be thinking about if they're just starting to think about this now as opposed to 30 years ago?
You know, I'll jump in here if you don't mind, Wayne, and sure. Suggest that fruiting trees provide the added benefit of the protection and a place to make a home habitat, as Ben said, which is absolutely correct. But a fruiting tree, like a crabapple, for instance, will produce fruit in a year. And as that year cycles through, we go through fall into winter, the crabapples usually stay on the tree until late winter, early spring. And that's when birds tend to forage for them, partly because they're migratory birds that are doing the foraging. So robins, for instance, they'll develop a great hunger for crabapples and also the fruit of mountain ash, the fruit of American cranberry. Those are fruiting plants that are attractive to birds this time of year, if we're talking about winter and late winter, early spring. Other fruiting trees, like the native service berry, for instance, the amelanchier, bear fruit that birds find attractive in the summer. So as soon as they become ripe, bingo, my service berries, and I have about 20 of them, get loaded down with cedar wax wings in July when the fruit comes ripe. So fruit would be one, and seeds would be another. And I know we're talking trees and shrubs, and there are lots of evergreen trees that produce cones this time of year that are attractive to birds, because birds, the available food to them in the winter, of course, is much more limited than it is in the spring, because the landscape is covered in snow in most of Canada, right?
Yep.
So cedar trees, spruce, fir, all the evergreens are very useful to birds this time of year. You'll notice that they tend to go there a lot. And this is not a nest building time. This is a time when they're basically in survival mode. They built up some fat back in the fall, and now you need to get them through, which we should talk about building up fat, and we should talk mm-hmm. about suet and peanuts and, you know, protein.
Dad had one good key word in what he was saying there, and a lot of these things are native. And that's true of the taller trees you plant too, right? Like a white oak is perfect for nesting woodpeckers and jays, that sort of thing. But also red maples, black, red, white spruce, you know, native is really key word.
Right. Absolutely. So, yeah, the fat is really important, and there's a lot of oil and fat in those seeds. So that's why the seeds are so important for the birds, right?
That's right.
Correct.
So let's talk about, because you talked about peanuts and stuff, let's talk about the different kinds of feed that you can get for birds at a grocery store or at even a seed store. I know that you, Mark, you're very disparaging of cracked corn, which is like sort of like a filler, right, that's in seed. So
well, it is. You have to ask yourself the question when you're buying bird seed, what birds do I want to attract?
Right.
Some bird seed doesn't attract birds at all, or not very much, or very limited range. Cracked corn tends to attract mourning doves and pigeons and, you know, the ground feeders. So what happens is it gets kicked out of the bird feeder by the songbirds you really want to attract to your yard, the attractive songbird. And the ground feeders may come and pick it up. They may not, but I can tell you the squirrels love it. And if you're trying not to attract squirrels and other vermin to the bird feeder, don't put cracked corn in it. The other thing is, strictly from a purchasing point of view, buying cheap a bird seed usually means that it's been filled with cracked corn because it's very inexpensive. So it's treated as a filler in the business, and a good quality bird seed blend just doesn't have it.
The other one you want to look out for in that sense is safflower, right?
That's true.
There's a few different fillers.
Right. A friend of mine said safflower will be the last bird seed you ever buy, and that's because your bird feeder will never empty.
Now, folks can go to, there's a place here, I'm recording this in Hamilton, and there's a place here called Vogel Seeds, and they specialize in bird seed, and you can buy it in bulk. So people don't have to go to a grocery store and just buy a small bag. They can actually sort of bulk up on this stuff for the winter, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I would bulk up with black oil. If I was buying one single seed species of some kind, it would be the black oil sunflower seed. Very high in protein. And it attracts the broadest range of songbirds of any single seed that you could put in your feeder. So start there.
So let's talk about the feeders. Like, there's a wide variety of feeders, and I think that, you know, folks, when they're trying to think about, you know, what do I attract, what seeds do I put in, it's just a weird kind of mix and match that you got to sort of wrestle with. So what are some key things to attract the kinds of, as you mentioned, sort of the attractive songbirds as opposed to the sort of nuisance pigeons and mourning doves?
Something we didn't really talk about in feed, but I think is important, especially for fat content, is suet bricks. And I get great action on a suet feeder, and it doesn't have to be a complicated ordeal. The best suet feeder we've got, anyway, between us, I've got one, Dad's got one, is an upside down suet feeder, because the birds you want to attract are going to feed on it upside down anyway. And it's going to attract fewer squirrels and pests, and it's also going to have less exposure to the weather, because rain kind of beats away at these suet blocks. So it's a really simple thing. You can get one for about $20 or less. But I would say if I had one endorsement, it'd be an upside down suet feeder with a quality suet brick.
I like that, Ben. And keep this in mind too, for listeners to this podcast that really don't like grackles. Not that there's technically anything wrong with grackles, but they tend to travel in huge flocks and they tend to take over wherever they go, seasonally speaking. So they don't like to feed upside down. Woodpeckers do. And woodpeckers love suet, to Ben's point, and they prefer to be upside down. So you'll get the downy, the hairy. From time to time, you might even get a real red-headed woodpecker, like the Woody Woodpecker cartoon woodpecker. And you'll also get that Woody Woodpecker. Ben knows this story, so I'm sorry if I'm boring him, but I just about dropped my coffee cup the morning I saw Woody the Woodpecker on my peanut feeder. And peanuts are another great way to attract birds that are really hungry for that protein fix this time of year. Peanut feeders, you don't put in peanuts from the grocery store unless they are bird feeding specifically, because birds can't have salt.
And one of the remarkable things about birds, I think, is watching like a cardinal crack a seed, or, you know, they're kind of amazing at getting through the shells, even the tough husks and stuff. And so it's fascinating to see sort of the detritus underneath the feeder as all these shelled seeds actually get eaten by birds that have figured out how to do this. It's kind of amazing.
Well, their dexterity is amazing. You're right, Wayne. And that's a good reason for having a window bird feeder, a place right on the kitchen window, or I'm talking about a window that you tend to look through a lot. That's the place. That sill on the outside of your house is a great place to have a bird feeder and to put some black oil sunflower seed or a specialized sunflower mix would be perfect. Get the cardinal there. Later in the season, you might get a grosbeak or two, and it's so much fun to see them that close.
And you're also going to get, in terms of seed, if you have something like a coneflower or something, you're going to have them the birds feeding on those plants themselves, and they can bob along and stuff. So that's interesting to watch as well.
Well, we haven't talked about perennials and other plants you can put in your garden this coming season that will stand. The rule number one is this, Wayne. Don't cut your perennials back in the fall. Leave them standing. Number one reason to leave them standing, the seed heads provide nutrition and winter interest for us, nutrition for birds. And if you want to cut them back in the spring, that's fine. A lot of people will do that. But don't sanitize your garden come fall. And make sure that you plant perennials that stand on their own through the winter months with a nice seed head on them, like the purple coneflower that you just mentioned.
Right. So let's wrap up by talking about some of the issues that folks face, or some things that people should take into consideration so that they're not doing harm to bird life. And one of the things I want to touch on in a broad sense is nearby, this is the Royal Botanical Gardens, and they really eschew people from feeding the birds on the trails and stuff. Is there a danger with people feeding birds in their backyards that even that act is going to unbalance the ecosystem, or is it now become just sort of part of the ecosystem?
Well, I think Ben will agree that so much of the information we have and so much of what we've learned over recent years, we've learned from Jody Allaire at Bird Studies Canada. Now, these people approach birding from a scientific point of view, and they assure us that when Canadians feed birds in their backyard, they are in no way upsetting the natural balance of things. And secondly, they're not making birds reliant on bird food out of your feeder. They have lots of natural sources. We are doing this for our own entertainment, and there's really no other practical reason for it. Ben, would you add anything to that?
No, I fully agree. I think if you can provide habitat in your own backyard, that's great. But singularly, they don't become dependent in that sense. They just travel too much.
Right. So let's talk about other animals that like the feeder for a variety of reasons. So I'm thinking particularly of squirrels and cats. So what are the issues around those, and how can people mitigate that so that the birds aren't harmed, or that the squirrels aren't eating all their food?
Well, Ben has some good advice on cats. Go for it, Ben.
Just keep it indoors, unfortunately. And that's not every cat owner is going to be happy to hear that. But they are the number one predator is domesticated cats. I've heard something like 180 million birds a year in North America lost to cats. And bells, I'm told, like a bell around the neck by Bird Studies Canada, are not necessarily effective for preventing cats from catching those birds. So keep the feeders far, far away from the house. And if at all possible, just keep the cat inside.
Right. So, you know, could I add two things to that? Number one, Ben says keep the cat inside. Quite frankly, what we do is we try to keep the cat inside during the day, and then we let her out at night. and she's not going to harm a lot of birds at night because they're not very active, number one. And when he talks about keeping the bird feeder as far away from a window as possible, because window kills are another problem. They see a reflection of your garden or your yard or maybe themselves in the window, and they think that it's a flow through. So they hit the window at full speed, and of course, that's the end of the bird. So you can put things on your window to minimize that occurrence. And if there's food, a bird feeder, within 30 feet of the window, that's a danger as well. So move it 30 feet away or within 5 feet. So really close to the window or 30 feet or more away from the window. The danger zone is that 5 to 30 foot zone.
What can people do about squirrels? Because we see lots of, squirrel baffling, spring loaded, and they're not baffled. They're just not baffled. So what can folks do?
The best success we've had with squirrel control on our property was getting a dog. Our dog has no interest in birds, but she loves chasing squirrels, and that keeps them out of the yard. But really, I'd love to see a perfect squirrel-proof feeder because in our experience, that just doesn't exist. However, there are some that are better than others. It's just a matter of managing your own expectations. So squirrel-resistant, maybe. Squirrel-proof, probably not.
Right.
And the best squirrel-resistant feeder that I've found is one that's spring-loaded. It has basically a metal cage wrapped around the feeding tube itself, and they're quite expensive. I wish I could give you the exact name of it. It's squirrel something, bird feeder, but they run between $70 and $120 depending on the model. And I've seen them available at Home Hardware, and I've also seen them available at botanical garden gift stores, like right around the corner from you at the Royal Botanical Gardens wing.
Right.
They carry this very feeder. And if you don't mind parting with that kind of money, I have two of them, and quite frankly, I don't have a problem with squirrels on those feeders. But the other advice I would give listeners to this podcast would be love them. Love your squirrels. Learn to just enjoy them for the nuisance they are. We all have children like that. We learn to love them.
Right? Right. Oh, come on.
Yeah, we've attached a Slinky to the pole of our feeder, and it doesn't really work terribly well, but it's really amusing to watch the squirrels climb the Slinky. So
I've seen that work really well.
Yeah. So I wanted to end off because you mentioned scientists and work looking at the ecology of bird feeding. The other thing I wanted to touch on, and you guys have written about it, is the idea of the sort of citizen science aspect of bird feeding and bird watching. Can we talk a little bit about that, about what folks can do in terms of contributing to things like, Project Nest Watch and others to get a sense of what kind of density of birds and what kind of variety of birds are available? What can folks do?
Well, with anything, I guess any scientist would tell you that the quality of data is a starting point to really understanding the subject. Birds are so diverse, they travel so far. Having this distribution of people who can help monitor their patterns is essential for Bird Studies Canada and what they do. So they run all sorts of programs for monitoring migratory birds that are all based around citizen science to inform their research. And I think the best thing to do, honestly, is to go to birdstudiescanada.com and look at what's near you. But they are seasonal, of course, because it's migratory birds. And the Christmas bird count is a really big one for the winter bird watchers.
Okay, well, thank you very much, guys, for taking the time to help us figure out how to best feed winter birds. And, Ben, I understand you're just going on a belated honeymoon into Chile and Argentina. So have a great time down there, and don't get too meat drunk in the restaurants.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Thanks,
just
guys.
Just one thing, Wayne, if I can suggest to our listeners that they'll learn a lot more if they go to markcullen.com, where all of our written material, including what we do for Harrow Smith, is online. And you can sign up for our free monthly newsletter there too, markcullen.com, for more information and 10,000 gardening questions answered.
Okay, cool. Thanks very much, guys. Have a good day.
Thank you, Wayne.
Okay, bye-bye. That was Ben and Mark Cullen. Happy honeymoon, Ben. Craig Daniels works at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto as a project manager and scientific writer and editor, so it's not surprising that he and his partner, Ben Packets, took a scientific approach to making cider. They wrote about that process in Harrow Smith magazine and in the latest issue of the Harrow Smith Almanac. I spoke with Craig recently about fermentation, cider, and the apple-strewn path he eschewed a few years back. Here's that conversation. Craig, thanks very much for joining me. I want to start by talking about your early days. In your piece, you talk about being in Granada. I guess that was from 2006 to 2009, right? And having some experience with fermented food in general. Can you talk a little bit about that time?
Yeah, I mean, it was a really interesting time to change countries and, you know, move to a whole other space in the world. And, you know, we've always been really interested in food, and we were gifted the book, the Sandor Katz book, which we both read, and it was really interesting to us to try these some of these methods out to make fermented foods rather than just prepared foods or cooked foods.
When you talk about fermented foods, we're talking about foods that you eat, like a sauerkraut, but also foods that you drink, like kefir or beer or cider. So can we talk a little bit, because you are a scientist, your background is science, what's going on there with bacteria and food, and why isn't it all just evil and poisonous as opposed to being helpful and breaking down some of the nutrients and stuff? Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. I mean, a lot of people, you know, are very scared of bacteria and fungus and things like that, but they're actually all around us, and something that, you know, we've lived with, you know, through millennia. A lot of foods actually have some sort of fermentation involved: sauerkraut, kimchi, pickles, yogurt, sourdough bread. You know, there's essentially three basic forms of fermentation: lactic acid fermentation, acetic acid fermentation, which is where you get apple cider vinegar from, for example, and then obviously alcohol fermentation, where we get wine, beer, ciders, things like that. And so they're actually very useful, and they're an important part of food resource for humans, actually, because they do make more nutrients available.
There seems to be sort of a fine line between stuff getting better or more flavorful or more nutrient-rich and stuff rotting. And sometimes it seems like even though stuff rots, it's still okay to eat. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is true. I mean, it can certainly go awry. Like, if it smells really, really bad, it's probably not going to be any good for you. But, you know, I know that's not a very scientific way of doing things, but, you know, people have fermented foods for a long time. It's not really something that would routinely make you ill. Certainly fermenting alcohol is rarely going to make somebody ill.
Let's talk about cider, because that was the sort of focus of the piece that you did for Harris Smith magazine. And you approached the process of making cider, not surprisingly, like a science experiment. So, and when I've talked to beer makers in the past, they approach it very scientifically in terms of very clean equipment, very careful attention to time, very careful attention to temperature. Walk me through how you approach it as a sort of scientist, and how most people should approach this process.
Like, you really want to control the environment as best as possible. So you definitely need the airlock on top of the carboy, so that you only have carbon dioxide basically being pumped out of the unit by the yeast as it makes the alcohol. And you should keep it in a darker place, not in a sunlit place. Well, I mean, we put ours down in the basement, our carboys, and I sit it on a towel so it's not getting temperature fluctuation from the concrete or the basement floor. And, you know, it's a fairly stable temperature. Like, a basement is a great place because it tends to stay at the similar sort of temperature right throughout the year. Yeah, that's really the type of things that you have to do. I mean, as well as making sure that the carboy is clean and, you know, we use the iodine solution that we recommend in the article. Works very well.
Somebody like me, for example, who, as I said, we're going to be harvesting apples that we found, so we wash them well, as you suggest, and stuff. But we don't have any winemaking equipment now. So starting from scratch, what would be the outlay in terms of having the equipment you would need to make a nice cider?
I think it would be around $60 to have a start, set yourself up a starter kit with two carboys, because you need two, because you want to be able to rack off the cider after you've made it, because you need to take it off of the lees and the wasted yeast that's at the bottom. And, you know, a vinometer is one of the best purchases we ever made. People use other devices to measure the alcohol. It's very cheap. I think it was $7 or something like that from a winemaking store. And it works very quickly to be able to tell you what the approximate alcohol concentration is. You know, you need the tube and a funnel and stuff like that, but it's really not very much outlay. The yeast is a couple of dollars for the package, $1.50 or something like that.
Now, in the piece you mentioned that you were looking around when you came back from Spain and thought, wow, you know, we're here in Ontario, there's all these great apples, but there's not a big cider industry. There's not a lot of ciders coming out of Ontario. But that was in 2009 that you came back from Spain. So the landscape has really changed since then. Can you talk about what's happened over the last few years?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, and I'm really excited and very happy that it has happened, because there really are a lot of apples in Ontario, and it's great that they're now being used as a beverage, or, you know, outside of just eating apples or just straight cider or pressed juice. And yeah, there's certainly a lot of companies making cider now. Even the big companies have tried to join in to do that. You know, obviously some of the ciders are aromatized. They're not actually true ciders, but many of the good ones, the smaller ones in Ontario, are actually proper ciders.
Do you feel like you and your partner sort of missed the boat on this back in 2009, looking around saying, hey, there's not very many ciders, we should rock on this and make some stuff, and then all of a sudden, kapow, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that if we'd have, you know, had the maybe the intestinal fortitude, you never know, right, to, you know, leap out of our day jobs and go and try something like that, because we are both scientists and we understand, like, how to, you know, do this type of thing. Obviously, we would have needed some help, but, yeah, it would have been great to do something like that. And we probably did miss the boat seeing what was coming. But, you know, it's good that somebody else saw it and other people are doing it. And, you know, it's great for Ontario.
Well, thanks very much for doing the piece, because it really sort of inspired me to think about, okay, this is the fall that I'm going to make some cider and actually exploring some other kind of fermented food. Thanks for taking the time to do this today.
No problem. Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure. We really enjoyed it.
That was Craig Daniels, an amateur but ardent ciderist and scientist. So, here we are at the end of this episode of Harris Smith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple iTunes or in your favorite podcast player. And please, tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrissmithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. Until next time, for Harris Smith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harris Smith Radio.